right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And it's a packed show, as I always say. It's really packed today, though. It's really, really packed. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Marshall Crenshaw, singer, songwriter, and musician. And we'll be talking with Marshall about Jail Guitar Doors. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we'll be talking on Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand for the national anthem. This is going to be a hell of a discussion, a very important discussion. It's just rocking a lot of people's minds right now. Opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing back to the show Sansara Taylor. And Sansara is joining us to talk about a subject that has been very, very sharply posed for everybody, unless you're buried under a rock. But even then, it's probably even sharply posed for people objectively. It's the attack that's come down on Nate Parker. He's the director and writer, co-writer of the film Birth of a Nation. And there's been a massive assault that's been unleashed against Nate, connected up with a rape charge that he was accused of rape back, 20 years ago or 17 years ago or something. And he was found innocent on that. And yet this has come up now. And it's very, very interesting, to say the least, that it's come up at exactly the time that this killer film, Birth of a Nation, an amazingly powerful film that has the potential of really dramatically drawing some very sharp lines and polarizing things in a way that they need to be polarized in a certain sense. And joining us to talk about this, as I said, is Sansara Taylor. She's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and she is the initiator of Stop Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, it's good to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you here. We're going to jump in because I don't want to spend any time talking. I want you to talk. But you recently wrote an article that I was blown away by it. I thought it was so important. It was around this controversy around Nate Parker and Birth of a Nation. And the title of the article is The Birth of a Nation Can Contribute to Liberation. Reprosecuting Nate Parker Does Not. Let's jump into, what were you getting at there?
Well, just to fill everybody in case you haven't heard about this, The Birth of a Nation is a new film that was written, it's directed, and it stars Nate Parker. And it's about the rebellion of Nat Turner, the slave rebellion. It's one of the most heroic and righteous uprisings in American history. And it is not just a story of the horrors that were inflicted on Black people during slavery, which would be important to tell, or even nonviolent resistance. This is a bloody revolt, and it was a righteous revolt. And this is the kind of thing that everybody needs to look at. Everybody needs to confront it. Gets to the nature and the essence of what America has been founded on and continues to carry out: the oppression of Black people, the terror. Today it's by police. It used to be by the Klan. Before that it was the slave overseer and the slave catchers. And the forms have changed, but it's continued. And so I myself have not seen this film, but it's a big deal that such a film has been made. It broke the records for the highest selling independent film ever out of Sundance Film Festival. It got rave reviews everywhere it's been reviewed, and it's coming out October 7th. It was billed to be a major release in Hollywood across the country, and right on the eve of this being released, Variety Magazine, New York Times, a number of major publications, gatekeeper publications that have a lot of, represent different sections of the rulers in this country, decided to dredge up and splash all over the front pages that 17 years ago Nate Parker was accused of raping a woman. And that's a serious charge. Rape is a horrific crime, not only to the women who are victims of it, where it shatters their lives. You never recover from being raped. It's a horrific crime. But it's also a weapon that's used to terrorize all women, whether they're victims of it or not. It's a form of enforcing patriarchy and the oppression of women in this country and around the world. So it's not a light charge. It's not something to dismiss, but it is highly suspect, I'll put it this way, that 17 years later, and he was tried, he was put on trial, he was found not guilty of this accusation. 17 years later, no new evidence has come out. Nothing has changed, except he's about to release this film that is very, very, could be very powerful and touches right to the core of what a lot of the rulers in this country and powerful forces in this country do not want people to look at. So right when this film, Birth of a Nation, is about to be released, this controversy is dredged back up. Or it wasn't a controversy, it was turned into it. It's a manufactured controversy. And a lot of people took the bait. I have to say, I was very disappointed and upset that a lot of people, including a lot of prominent Black voices, feminist voices, came out and said, look, you know what? I'm not going to go see this film because of this. And I think it's very wrong. It's very damaging, and it goes against the interests of the people. And I hope we can sort that out some. And because my point is not to dismiss or belittle the problem of patriarchy and rape, but to actually sort out what was true and who and what is served by turning this into a controversy now, casting a huge cloud over this film. And frankly, I think that it works against the liberation of women. It works against the liberation of Black people. It works against a method of understanding what's true and creating a culture where art and radical ideas can flourish for people to take the bait and turn their backs on this film because of this controversy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking about this as you were talking and thinking about it in reading your article a couple of times and, you know, just having talked to a lot of people who've seen it, who've seen the film and people who know about it and have looked into it. You know, this point that you're making right now about this being a manufactured controversy is extremely important. At the same time, what you've been talking about is about the impact of rape and the horror that rape is and how it's so endemic to this society, to this kind of society. I mean, all over the world, this is one of the major questions facing humanity is the horror of rape and abuse facing women. At the same time, the point that you make in the article is extremely important, that the importance of being of not guilty, those two words, the inner court, not guilty, you know, and scientifically determining the truth as opposed to having a trial by tyranny. And one of the things you quote in your piece, which I really recommend people go to revcom.us and read your piece on this. It's really important that people dig into this and think about it and spread it around. But you quote Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, saying, "For humanity to advance beyond a state in which might makes right and where things ultimately come down to raw power relations, will require as a fundamental element in this advance an approach to understanding things, an epistemology which recognizes that reality and truth are objective and do not vary in accordance with nor depend on different narratives and how much authority an idea or narrative may have behind it or how much power and force can be wielded on behalf of any particular idea or narrative at any given point." This is an extremely important point in relation to all this. So let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a big idea. You just read that quote. There's a lot packed into it. But I'll say this is that if we want to get free, the world is a complicated place. And we have to go for what's true. We have to understand the evidence. We have to look and follow the facts and the evidence wherever they lead us. And we can't respond. You know, one of the big arguments that's been made around this case and this controversy is, look, women who have been raped are so often shamed and blamed and disbelieved when they come forward. And so often men who rape women get away with it. So we have an obligation to believe the victim. She must be telling the truth. And in this case, the woman who made the accusation later committed suicide. And it's a great tragedy. So she's not in the picture anymore to tell her story at all. But I think that the logic of that is very damaging. The fact that men often get away with rape, the fact that women are overwhelmingly shamed and blamed and disbelieved, that has to be fought. But that has to be fought on the basis of marshaling the evidence that shows, no, rape happens all the time. No, it's excused, it's belittled, and it's woven into the culture and the fabric and the legal system and the economy and the religious codes and the traditions of thousands of years, and we need to make a revolution to uproot all of that. But that can be shown with evidence. To respond to that with a knee-jerk that, well, rather than choosing to dismiss the victims all the time, let's choose to believe the victims all the time. You know, to do that as a response, you may think you're siding with the underdog, but actually you're throwing away the measure of what makes something true, which is the evidence. And by doing that, this is where we come back to that quote you just read from Avakian. He makes the point, if we want to get to a world where the truth is not determined by might makes right, you know, I say there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I have an army to back it up. So there, we'll print it on the front page. We'll tell it. We'll call everybody who disputes it a lunatic and a conspiracy theorist, and then we'll bomb a country and destroy a whole people. That's might makes right. The facts be damned. If we want to get to a world beyond that, we have to fight for an epistemology and an approach to understanding what's true that's based on evidence and scientifically grounded evidence, digging into what's actually true, what corresponds to objective reality, and not saying, let's choose our own narrative in opposition to that. And if that's the best you do, you're never going to get beyond a world where might makes right. And so there's a lot of implications for that in how we fight today and how we sort out something that's highly complex, like the fact that women are often disbelieved and the fact that accusations of sexual assault and rape against Black men have been a license to kill. I mean, we talk about the Scottsboro Boys, we talk about Emmett Till, we could talk about the Central Park Five and many, many other cases. How do you sort that out and not just pick between which narrative you choose that you think might be useful and serve your immediate interest? But how do you sort it through? You have to go for the evidence. And in this case, I did read a huge portion of the transcript of the trial. I read a lot of the evidence that was admitted. I read a lot of the statements that were illegally, a lot of the evidence that was illegally obtained by police breaking the law and illegally recording Nate Parker years ago. And I read all this, and I don't know if he was guilty or not. I'm not making that claim. I do know that he engaged in sexual conduct with this woman that was at minimum very degrading, very dehumanizing, and is part of the culture of patriarchy, and we should fight that. And we should challenge that, and that should be changed. But I also know that in reading this, every single argument that I have read that says, well, Nate Parker must be guilty, it's not substantiated by the facts of this case. It's just not. And so that matters. And it matters to what kind of culture we want to have. It matters to whether individuals can change. This was 17 years ago. He was engaged in things that were very degrading to women. But this was 17 years ago, and people have to be allowed to change and transform and to scapegoat a 19-year-old for the culture that this country propagates and to demonize him rather than going at the whole system. And yes, holding him accountable, but all men and all people who participate in this, but then not letting that be used, not letting people's legitimate concern and righteous fury about rape be used to bury a film which actually should be evaluated on its merits, not on the basis of the artist anyhow, even if he had been guilty. So there's a lot of layers to this. How do we see art? How do we see an atmosphere where people are allowed to change and transform? And how do we not let different sections of the oppressed be pit against each other?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara Taylor is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and she's also the founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And Sansara is also an advocate for the work of Bob Avakian. And we're talking with Sansara today about the assault on Nate Parker, and particularly the assault on his film, Birth of a Nation.
See, that's something I was really interested in, and you spoke about that. You hit at that a couple times in your piece. And it's this point of actually, you know, look, a lot of people, you know, or some people, not a lot, I don't even know how many people would do this, but it is definitely out there. There's people saying, well, look, if you're taking the stand that you're taking, somehow you're not taking seriously the oppression of women. And you're doing that because opportunistically you think he's made an important film that should be out there, and you're willing to turn your head to whatever else he may have done. And I think that it's really important for people to be clear on what's being said there and what's the truth in terms of what's happening here. I've read a lot of editorials, a lot of opinion pieces where people come up and they constantly start with this, you know, sort of wink, wink. Yes, he was found not guilty, but we know he actually did some dastardly stuff. You know, this is sort of, you hit again in your article too, and it's related to the first thing I said, is that this point you just started to talk about, people can change and the system can't. And there's a big important difference between those two things. And I'd like to talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that you just mentioned. To begin with, I want to go back to the first point you made about if you support this film, you're not taking rape seriously. That's not true. This film should be evaluated on its own merits. It should be seen as a piece of art, and it has a great contribution to make, potentially. I have not seen it, but I think people need to see it. But I would like to compare that argument to those who said, look, if you don't support the U.S. imperialist invasion of Iraq 12 years ago, or however many years ago it was, then you don't care about the oppression of women. I mean, of Afghanistan and then Iraq, then you don't support the fight against the oppression of women there, because that was one of the excuses that was being used. Oh, we have to go in there to liberate women. Well, you can have genuine concern about the oppression of women, and you should, around the world, including in those places, and you should fight that. But that does not mean that you should allow your concern to be used as a cover to carry out war crimes. Now, I know it's a different situation, but the analogy holds. Legitimate concern and fury against rape needs to actually grow and needs to be an even bigger fight that gets waged among many more people. But it should not be used. We should not allow ourselves to be used and that concern to be used as a cover by ruling class interests and reactionary interests to bury a film that needs to be seen, to carry out something that actually goes against the interests of the people. And I will say it's not every day the New York Times runs a front page story 3 days in a row about a independent film, you know, and a 17-year-old allegation. that's been disproven. It's not every day that, and whatever the intent of those who wrote the article, I'm not doubting the sincerity of the feminist voices and the Black voices who spoke out against this, but their voices don't always get elevated in this way. You know, they don't always get elevated in this way. They're being used right now, and they're allowing themselves to be used, it's harmful, and it's not backed up by the facts, and that matters. And then just to get, I know we're going to run out of time, so you asked the other question, which, you know, one of the things that was leveled against Nate Parker, people said he's hypocritical for insisting that America look at its past of slavery and then saying that he doesn't want to be put under a microscope every time he comes into the public eye and have the 17-year-old case dissected each time. And I'll say this, I don't think there's an analogy there. I don't think there's hypocrisy there. And I don't speak for Nate Parker, and he actually has come out and explored this past, and he seems to be learning and transforming and acknowledging that he never thought as deeply about rape and rape culture, and he's being forced to now, and that's a positive thing. So I'm not speaking for him, but I will say, actually, it proves the point. Nate Parker, like others, you know, there's a lot of people. We live in a dog-eat-dog, patriarchal, white supremacist society, and it breeds that in people. And people don't treat each other well. They're trained by this system to not treat each other well. And we have to fight for people to change as part of the fight to change the world and to make an actual revolution. But we also have to allow people the space to change. You think about the millions of people in prison, many of whom were caught up and things that shouldn't be criminal, nonviolent offenses, drugs, this kind of thing. But many of whom have done really harmful things. They have to be allowed to change and transform as part of changing the world. You can't hold people to the worst they've ever done in their lives and put them in a box and lock them there for life. And people can change, and that's very important. In contrast, this system, the system of America, American capitalism and imperialism today, it was founded on slavery. It was built up on white supremacy, theft of land from Mexico, genocide against Native people, invasions, coups, occupations, torture, exploitation, and plunder all over the world. This is its nature. It's a system. It's not a person. It's a system that has laws and dynamics and the way it operates. And if you deeply study that, and that's something Bob Avakian has done deeply, including in the new book coming out, The New Communism, which is on revcom.us, something that I've been studying. It's something that other people need to get into. The more you study that, the more you understand these are not incidental. They're not secondary traits. This is the core essence of America, and it cannot be reformed. And everybody has to confront that. You have to confront it. America was not, slavery was not some secondary thing that America improved and got beyond. It is still, the forms have changed, but the police are out killing Black people every day. Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Oscar Grant, Sean Bell, Ayanna Stanley Jones. You go every day, you open the newspaper today, tomorrow, you'll find another body in the street. And so this is, it's a different form, but this is integral to America. And so we have to confront that, and we should never forgive that. We should never forget that. We should never excuse that. We actually have to confront that, and we have to make a revolution to get rid of that. And so in that context, I think a film like this can contribute a great deal to shining a light, not only on the horrors of what this country has done, but on the righteousness of people rising up, including in a bloody rebellion like Nat Turner's. People need to look at that, and they need to go out of their comfort zone. It's not, so this has a contribution to make. Re-prosecuting Nate Parker, and especially, I know we're out of time, but this whole, you mentioned it, we didn't get to talk about it, but the media tyranny.
You can talk about that. Take a couple minutes and talk about that.
Yeah. Especially with a culture of media tyranny, trial by Twitter, a whole atmosphere which has been whipped up, which works against the oppressed. It works against seeking the truth, which is going to work against the oppressed. It's always going to feed those who have might because they're going to be able to churn out their opinions in a much bigger way. But what we saw with Nate Parker, people all over Twitter, people all over social media, people in all these blogs and front page articles saying, well, we know he was guilty. I was raped, so I am entitled to decide that he was guilty. We have all these people saying, well, there was a witness. I mean, I saw this over and over again. There was a witness who testified, who said that he was invited into this sexual encounter, and he declined. It was a drunken late night. What's in dispute is the woman says she did not consent. She was too drunk. And Nate Parker said she was fully participatory, and she consented. And that's in dispute. And it's a real dispute, and that goes on all the time, and it's not a good situation. But he says he was invited to take part in it, and he declined. He said it didn't seem right to me. So everybody took this quote, and they said, see, that shows he's guilty. No, that doesn't show he's guilty. That shows that somebody thought it was morally objectionable. That doesn't show that it was rape. But all these people, they pick it up. They didn't read this testimony. They didn't read the courts. They just repeat things over and over and over again. And then they create a culture where any denial on the part of the accused, on the part of Nate Parker, any denial on his part, any silence on his part, any attempt to defend himself and say, actually, the record shows I was acquitted. All this is used as further fuel to indict him, further fuel to say he's evading. And it's a mentality that once you're accused, everything you do just feeds the mob, honestly. The mob that has nothing to do with and no measure and no standard of discovering what's true. And people allow themselves to be led along like this. And it's very destructive. It's destructive in this case, and it has horrendous implications for the kind of culture that we should have, for the kind of search for the truth and the standards of truth that we should have. The world is complicated, and you cannot get free by allowing yourself to be led along by a rumor mill, even if it's in the name of stopping something like rape. You cannot allow yourself to be led along like that or go along with that. That has to be called out. It's very damaging, and not just for this film and not just for the individual who is Nate Parker, who does matter.
Mm-hmm.
For much, much bigger, much, much bigger implications about how do we sort things out and how do we get free.
Exactly. So. And I would just end on reiterating everything you've said, and also that the fact that, as you said, this film cannot be allowed to be buried under all this bull, basically. This film is extremely important to dig into and for people to see and defend. All right. And there's already been many moves to sort of stop it dead in its tracks, and that can't be tolerated. Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Take care.
Yeah, definitely. You too. And folks, you should read Sansara's article on revcom.us. All right. It's an extremely important article. It's called "The Birth of a Nation Can Contribute to Liberation. Re-prosecuting Nate Parker Does Not." We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dick. So stay tuned. I was going to start singing with that one, all right? Because that's just like, that gets me, all right, that's got me juiced up here, all right? And that's Sold as Freedom from Anti-Flag. All right, these things that jump out at us, they seem to come in a big bundle. And there's a whole storm that has been breaking out around a man named Colin Kaepernick. And he's a football player, a quarterback with the San Francisco 49ers. And he refused to stand for the national anthem. And it has unleashed a hellstrom in this country and around the world, and with people coming forward to defend him and to join with him, and other people attacking him, heraciously attacking him. And joining us to talk about all this is Carl Dix, who's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's also someone who has his own experience with standing up against the sacred sacraments of U.S. imperialism. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's jump into this real quick. Let's start off with your overall hit on what's going on with Colin Kaepernick.
Look, what Colin Kaepernick did, refusing to stand up for the national anthem and saying, look, I'm not going to celebrate the flag and the anthem of a country that oppresses black people and people of color, where their bodies in the street and people are getting paid leave and getting away with murder, referring to killer cops. That was fine. It was a breath of fresh air, because what he's talking about and what he's standing against is real. Police are getting away with murder all across the country. They're not isolated incidents. It's happening again and again and again, and there is no punishment, or almost no killer cops ever get punished. So it's very fine that he stood up. And look, when you take a stand like this, one where he put a whole lot on the line. I mean, because, look, he's a professional football player, multi-million-dollar contract, endorsements. And he knew when he took this stand, he was putting all of that on the line. And he even said, I might lose all of that. I might lose football. I might lose my endorsements. But this is bigger than me. This is about people's lives. And it would be selfish of me to not stand up because I might lose that stuff. That's very important. And that has challenged, it's had a big impact, and it's challenged a lot of people with, okay, where are you on this? And like you said, they're the haters, they're the reactionaries, they're all these people who are coming out against him, but there are also others who are standing with Colin Kaepernick. There are other professional athletes, like Eric Reed, who's a teammate of his, joined him in this. A player from the Seattle Seahawks, the professional football team in Seattle, joined last week. And this week, the whole team is talking about doing a team effort in support of it. A soccer player, last name Rapinoe, I forget her first name, she took a knee for the national anthem. There were in the Women's Professional Basketball Association who had actually turned their backs on the anthem before, other prominent people. And then just a lot of other people are standing with Kaepernick. And this is all very important because it has put before society the question of not only standing with somebody who's standing against police murder and police getting away with murder, but because he's doing it around the national anthem, it has posed the question of, well, what's America about anyway? And that's a very important question for people to get into.
Well, let's get into it, man, because that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is what is this national anthem all about? And why does it break out so horrifically around the national anthem?
Well, because, look, one of the things that they try to, you know, just beat into people's heads is that you have to be with this country and what it does here in this country and around the world. I mean, I went through that myself growing up and being drafted into the Army. And, you know, you're growing up, you're supposed to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, put your hand on your heart, stand up for the national anthem. That got even more intense when I was in the military. And then when I got the orders to go to Vietnam, I was like, well, what is it that they're going to have me do? What is going on in Vietnam? And I had to dig into that. And I ended up finding out that it was a genocidal war trying to drown the liberation struggle of the Vietnamese people in blood. And I said, I could not be a part of that. And I refused to go to Vietnam. In fact, I did it with five other GIs. We were the Fort Lewis Six, the largest mass refusal to go to Vietnam. And that had me going to, well, what is this country about anyway? Genocidal wars around the world, the savage brutality that was being heaped on black people for standing up against the injustices done to them back then. And frankly, I got sent to Leavenworth Military Penitentiary for refusing to go to Vietnam. And I came out of Leavenworth as a revolutionary. And actually, the last time I stood up for the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance was when I was in the Army. It's been more than 40 years. Because I got a sense of what America's about, and everybody has to do that. Everybody's got to say, well, what is this country about? They want us to celebrate it by doing rituals to its flag and anthem. Well, what is this about? What is this country about? And you look at it historically, it's slavery of African people. It's genocide against the native inhabitants. It's invasions and wars and plunder all the way through the history of America. It's dropping atomic bombs that incinerated tens of thousands of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and it continues today. It isn't just a history lesson here. There's the more than a million people in the Middle East who've been killed by the United States. There's the mass incarceration of more than 2 million people, most of them black or Latino. There's the terror and the demonization of the immigrants, with almost 2 million immigrants deported in the last 5 years alone by the deporter-in-chief, Barack Obama. There's the fact that the metal needed for our cell phones and computers and the clothes that we wear, that gets produced by men, women, and children being grindingly exploited all around the world. There's the chewing up of the environment of the planet. This is what America is all about. This is what the flag and the anthem symbolize, and nobody should celebrate that. Nobody should stand up for that anthem. Nobody should recite that pledge unless they're ready to say, I'm down with all these horrors. And there are a whole lot of people who do it because it's what you're supposed to do. It's what you get herded into. People got to break with that. People got to no longer say, I'm going to go along with this stuff because it's the way things are. They have to actually look at what is the history, what's the legacy, and what's the current day reality of this country. And then even more than that, they got to do something else that I did, because the reason I became a revolutionary was I saw the horrors that were being committed in Vietnam and in Mississippi. But I had to get to, well, why do these horrors happen again and again? And I found that it was because of this system and this capitalist imperialist system and the very way that it worked. But I also found that there was a way out, and that way out was through revolution. And that's what led me to hook up with the Revolutionary Communist Party and the leadership of Bob Avakian decades ago, and it's a stance that I am still with. And people need to dig into, why do these horrors continue today? And they also need to dig into, what is the way out? And a part of that digging in has to be engaging the leadership and the work of Bob Avakian. And there's a very good way to do that right now, because he's got a new book that's coming out, The New Communism, which is going to drop in October, and people need to be reading that. They can begin reading it now, because pre-publication copies are up on revcom.us, and they need to get the book when it comes out. But that's what people need to do, because these horrors are real. And again, back to Colin Kaepernick, he really did a very fine thing and a very necessary thing by posing this question in a way that all of society had to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, we've got about maybe 5 more minutes, and I wanted to kind of stretch something out here to you, because when you were talking about people who came forward to support this, it made me think about, you know, basically how deep the things about the society, that some very deep things were revealed about this society and what's happening to people, where things are at today. And this whole concentration, what Kaepernick did, actually, whether he understood it or not, completely or fully himself or on this level, it posed some very big questions for people. And I was thinking about that because I read somewhere where, along with all the other current day athletes you were naming, also people like John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Kareem, they actually stood up and supported him. There's a very sharp thing, I think, going on here that people need to recognize, because it actually speaks to exactly what you're saying. If you're talking about fundamentally changing this society, if you're talking about revolution, if you're talking about a new world, this is not something that's sort of a pipe dream. It's actually rooted in what is going on, and people are facing big questions today.
Yeah, and when you talk about it, we could also add people in the arts like Spike Lee, like Chuck D, W. Kamau Bell, the comedian, the actress Susan Sarandon, Michael Moore, the filmmaker. And here's another thing that was an unexpected thing, and that is the veterans for Kaepernick, that just a swarm of them. Because one of the ways they used to try to come at him was that he was being disrespectful of the people in the military by his stand of not standing up for the anthem. And see, here's the first thing on this. People need to stop knuckling under to them trying to cite the military and the veterans as, well, they're with this, so you can't go against it. Because, look, the U.S. military is an institution that carries out around the world all of these horrors that I've been talking about, the drone missile strikes, the bombing of villages in Pakistan, in Yemen, and other places, the war in Vietnam, all kinds of invasions around the world. This has been the U.S. military doing it, and people should stop saying, I support the troops. And they should say, what are these troops doing? and they should support. Because if somebody says to me, they find out I'm a veteran, they say to me, I thank you for your service. I say to them, don't thank me for my service. Thank me for when I refused to serve, because I refused to go to Vietnam to serve as a part of that. But what happened is, as they were trying to use the veterans against Kaepernick, a lot of veterans started, and this especially developed on social media, the hashtag Vets for Kaepernick developed, and people started sending pictures of themselves in military uniform and saying, I stand with Colin Kaepernick in his protest against this. And some people were doing it because they said, well, what I actually fought for was his right to speak out against what he felt was injustice. Others were saying, Kaepernick is right. Police getting away with murdering black people and people of color is a horrific injustice, and I want to stand with him against that. And see, it actually reflects that there are big problems that this system has. Because, yeah, they want to go around the world, and they are, in fact, the top imperialist dog all around the world. But to carry that out, they have to bring into their army people from many different backgrounds, people of all nationalities, working class people, people who have grown up in poverty, who have experienced some of the ugly reality of America. And they still have that experience, even if they get drawn into going around the world and being a part of committing these crimes. So when this question of police getting away with murder is dramatically posed by Kaepernick's bold stand, it brings to people, well, where do I stand in this? Where do I fit into this? And one guy said, look, I'm a black man. This could happen to me. Another guy said, I have to put on my uniform when I go out of the house, because I figure if a cop stops me walking down the street or driving and he sees a black man in an army uniform, he'd be less likely to murder me. Think about that. He'd be less likely to murder me if I have on the uniform. And then actually compare that to the history of America, because after World War I, there were numerous cases of black soldiers who had gone to Europe to fight in the war, which was supposed to be a war to make the world safe for democracy, who were brutally beaten, tarred and feathered, some of them stripped, because they had the nerve to wear a military uniform in public, with the message being, you might be good enough to use for cannon fodder, but when you come back to America, you're black and you do not deserve to wear the uniform. So that was historically how it came down. And now they're trying to use it like, okay, well, you were in the military, we want to use you against people who are standing up against the horrors that we bring down on black people. But a lot of black GIs, but not only black veterans, are standing with Kaepernick. And it actually speaks to some of the potential. And those are some of the people that I want to challenge. Continue to stand up. Join in this fight to stop these horrors, but also begin to dig into why these horrors happen again and again and again, and dig into what it's going to take to solve it. And look, we in the Revolutionary Communist Party, our leader, Bob Avakian, has addressed that. He's broken through on that. And this book, The New Communism, pulls it all together. You got to go to revcom.us, check that book out, and then also check out what we have to say on what's going on around Colin Kaepernick, what's happening with police murder, what's happening with the U.S., you know, going around the world and bombing people and destroying villages and all like that. Check out our exposures, but also check out what Avakian has to say about the way out. That's revcom.us. People really need to go there. They really need to dig into this, and they need to stand up and continue to stand up. That's a real challenge that objectively, even if he didn't mean it this way, Colin Kaepernick has challenged you, and you got to respond to that challenge.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back real soon, and I'm sure we'll be talking about a whole lot of stuff around this, so this and related issues. So, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
Sure. Oh, and by the way, real quick, where can people, I know you and Joey Johnson, who just is facing charges around the flag burning at the Republican convention. You guys have said, look, if there's some knuckleheads out there that want to debate this stuff, they want to argue about this stuff, they should, you've put out a challenge to them. You're more than willing to go up against them. There you go. Where can people find out about that real quick?
They can find out about that on the website, revcom.us, as well, because we've got a video up issuing that challenge, as well as a written challenge so that people can get it in that format, too. So go to the website, revcom.us, and look it up, because it's there as well.
All right. Thanks a lot, Carl. We will be we'll be in touch again soon, all right? And you can also go to Facebook and see all that, all right? Go to my Facebook and you can find all that, all right? So we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with, Marshall Crenshaw. So stay tuned.
Saw the folks down below crying. Heard them on the radio lying. Distant bells in the air ringing out. Do they hear? Do they know it's growing? Sitting here, they don't realize.
All right, welcome back. That is the voice of Marshall Crenshaw. The song is No Time. He looks stunned because he didn't know it was his voice.
My hearing is shot anyway.
No! There's thousands of people screaming no, okay? There you go. Anyway, the song is No Time, and it's from this I have to say, this album that was never meant to be an album, or was never intended to be an album, or grew into an album spontaneously, or whatever it was, number 392, the EP collection.
Yeah.
What a great idea, man. You should explain to people what that was, because this just, it just captures something about you, all right? I think it was really very cool.
So. Oh, all right. Well, I did this project where I released a new vinyl EP every 6 months. For 3 years, so there were six altogether. And originally, my idea was to do a new vinyl EP every 4 months, but then somebody explained to me that there's this thing called Record Store Day. So they came out on Record Store Day, twice a year for 3 years, and on each one of these vinyl EPs, there was an A-side, which was a new song from me, and then when you flip the thing over, there are two tracks. And on each EP, it would be a cover tune. Like No Time, for instance, is a song by The Move, which is this British rock group that I used to really like a lot. And they used to write a lot of songs that had like apocalypse as the theme, you know. That was like a recurring theme with them.
You live in America, man. What do you expect?
So, anyway, that's what it was. The EP, or I'm sorry, the CD that you mentioned, number 392, is just kind of like a compilation of stuff from the EPs. And that's for people that don't like vinyl records, you know, the CD holdouts or whatever.
All right. Well, we'll go with that one. You weren't talking about me.
That's the story.
There you go. All right. That's cool. Let's talk about this. You're in town to be part of Wayne Kramer's initiated Jail Guitar Doors concert. What got you into Jail Guitar Doors and being part of this?
Well, I've known about this endeavor of Wayne's and Wayne and Margaret's, I should say. I've known about it for, I guess, as long as they've been doing it. But this time around, they invited me to come out and play, and I was just really pleased and honored. You know, I give them high marks as human beings for doing this and for other things that they do. So they just, you know, said, well, come out and play on the show, if you will. And I said, you got it. Here I am. I think you know about Jail Guitar Doors, right?
Yeah.
It's like an outreach program that gets musical instruments in the hands of prison inmates, and they do concerts at correctional facilities, and they do songwriter workshops and so on and so forth. You know, the idea is to give incarcerated people access to means of self-expression. And, you know, it's just a really kind of a noble enterprise, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because when I was thinking about that, when I was thinking about Jail Guitar Doors, and I was just thinking about the people that have taken part in it and what's leading people to that, you know, it's very interesting because the prisons, there was just a prison rebellion yesterday, and this is the anniversary of the Attica rebellions. And it's very heavy when you're thinking about this, and you're thinking about, I spoke to somebody who did a piece in The New Yorker who I had interviewed him here, and he was talking about how people in various prisons have been, you know, they've actually been boiled to death in some of these prisons in Florida. And then you have people in Rikers. That is just a hellhole, you know. And you think about this: people are thrown in there and left to rot. They're considered not even human anymore, you know, by the system. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that really attracted me about what Wayne and Margaret and all the people that are involved in Jail Guitar Doors are doing. You know, that they're actually standing up and saying, "No, we won't allow this to happen." God.
You know, I was driving over here listening to this station and heard Heather Ann Thompson talking about her book about the Attica uprising. And Wayne told me last night that Heather also has a book about the city of Detroit that I'm really anxious to read now. But, you know, just listening to her talk about the Attica uprising, and I had to tell my kids at one point when they were in grade school, one day they asked me, you know, I was driving home with them, and they said, well, you know, why are there wars and all this stuff? And I just had to give it to him in a nutshell. I said, you know, I hate to tell you this, kids, but there's just, when it comes to the things that human beings will do to other human beings, the bad things, there's just no bottom to it, you know? It's like, and they were only like 6 and 8 years old, but I just figured, why not, you know, give it to them.
I terrorized my son when he was 3 years old. Learn, you'll learn that this system is just... But there's actually a truth to this in terms of both what you're saying, but it's also, you know, look, people aren't by nature looking out. They're not by nature out to kill each other, but there is a system that's and a culture that's promoted around that actually permeates the whole thing, that teaches people it's me before you, it's, you know, get before you're gotten, you know, kill before you're killed, all this stuff. And yet the system is actually doing these things. Like when Carl Dix was on talking about this is something that's always outraged me so, just so intensely. When you're looking at, we all have our cell phones here. You and I have our cell phone out. But the coltan that makes them run is mined by little kids in Africa who, you know, never see the sunlight. They die without seeing the sunlight because they're in there mining coltan for our cell phones, you know. And you think about this in terms of the world can and needs to be and can be different. And that's one of the things I'm really attracted to about Jail Guitar Doors.
Yes, for sure. You know, I mean, anytime somebody takes the time to try to do something to, you know, ease some of the ugliness of the world, you know, then you gotta respect that.
Tell me this, Marshall. Tell me this. What the hell's up with you guys from Detroit, man, or the surrounding area? You guys, it's very cool because when I, you know, listening to your music, I never paid attention to where you were from, okay? But then Wayne tells me, you know, oh, yeah, you know, he came up, he's around the same place, you know, Wayne's in Detroit, you're out just outside of Detroit. Detroit had a big impact on you culturally, you know, in a certain sense. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, indeed. I grew up in the Detroit area. I never say that I'm from Detroit, though, because I don't think, out of respect to the city, I don't feel like I should use Detroit as a generic term like some people do who are from the Detroit area. But, you know, I'm from what they call the outer ring suburbs. Like the northern cutoff line of the city of Detroit is 8 Mile Road. My town was between 11 and 12 Mile Road. So I'm, you know, right near the city. And when I was growing up in the Detroit area, like the city was still kind of the energy center of the whole region. Mm-hmm. It had a sense of pride about itself. And then, you know, over time I saw that kind of break down. Mm-hmm. But as far as music goes, I mean, it was just like really a vibrant place and still is during the time I was growing up.
Well, I had a question for you because one of the things, I mean, people listen to your music and there's a lot in it. I mean, even, you know, just, I read something where you were just citing some of the people that that basically whose music you really play and you cover and all this stuff. James McMurtry, which, by the way, Thank you. I really.
Oh, God, yeah, he's the best.
Yeah, yeah, it's just, wow. And but also, going down to the Everly Brothers, you know, and what happened to the Righteous Brothers, man? Come on. But anyway, there's this whole scene there, though, too, that you also, and I don't know if people know this, but you were deep into jazz.
Oh.
Which I that was a fascinating story I read, man, where you just, like, you know. And you stole your friend's parents' albums, right?
Oh, that's true, yeah. Well, I guess the jazz thing, you can take that back to Detroit radio. When I was in my teens, there was a really excellent radio station in Detroit called WABX. It was one of the first FM rock stations in the country. This is like 1967, 68. I'm in junior high school. And right at the very beginning of FM rock radio, you know, at least as far as ABX went, you know, it was guys that really knew their stuff. They were, it was radio for stone people, like for smart stone people is what it was, you know. But
I know those people.
Yeah, it was very eclectic always. And in Detroit in particular, it was really heavy on the jazz side of things, you know, like the influence of John Sinclair, former Detroit correspondent for Downbeat magazine. You know, like they used to play a lot of Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt by Pharoah Sanders. That was like an FM rock radio hit when I first started listening to FM rock radio. They play stuff like that. They play Alice Coltrane and this, that, and the other thing. And then they'd play J.B. Lenoir and Howlin' Wolf and Hound Dog Taylor. You know, they mixed all this other stuff, all this stuff that got purged, actually, within the first few years of WABX, you know. As it started to get a mass audience, it got more and more watered down. But I was really, really influenced by that radio station.
Now, tell me this, because we're running up on our time, but I also wanted to get real quick on this. Let me ask you this. One, actually, it's interesting, because, again, you musically, you just stretch a lot. Even though the type of music you do draws on a lot of things and a lot of different people, but also... Uh-huh. People that might not know, you played in a band that was sort of a reunion band for the MC5.
Oh, I did, yeah.
that was pretty cool, man. I was actually, I have to say that really, that was like slapped me in the head. I said, wow, really?
I think it was like that for a lot of people, actually. But I've known Wayne Kramer for ages, you know. I mean, I met him way back when I was first starting out in New York City. And, I don't know. Wayne likes me for some reason, and I like him. So we just, you know, like every now and then, one of us will say, oh, well, let's do this or let's do that, you know. And the DKT MC5 thing, I was surprised when he called me for that. And I thought to myself, you know, some people aren't really going to get this, you know, like from a marketing standpoint. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wasn't going to say no. It took me like a split second or less to tell him that I would go on the tour or play that body of work, you know, that was a gas.
You know, it's such a trip, too. And it leads me to the next question, and we have about 1 minute to get into this, but maybe a little bit more. But you've also said you've always found something very magical about music. And as I was thinking about you saying that, it actually follows from everything we've just touched on talking about today, the magical nature of music, which I think is really a really important and really interesting way to put that.
Mm. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It was just a word that came to mind when I was asked a question about why I do what I do, you know, somehow the word magical got in there. But yeah, I mean, God, it's a good word, right, to describe music, yeah. Unless it's crap music. But anyway.
Well, yours isn't, and it describes it well. Now,
you.
Let me just say again, all right, we're talking with Marshall Crenshaw, and Marshall is part of Jail Guitar Doors. Marshall Crenshaw, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, we'll have to come back and talk about your whole body of work sometime soon, man. Soon. We'll do it. I'll get hold of you. Anyway, all right. I want people to know also that this is, as I said, this is the anniversary of the Attica Rebellion. It's also the anniversary of the death of Mao Zedong, a person who was one of the greatest revolutionaries in the world, okay? And he did a tremendous amount of stuff to actually try and change the world in a way that we wouldn't have to live like in the horrors that we live in. So check that out. All right, I want to thank Marshall Crenshaw and all of my guests today. I want to thank Sansara Taylor and Carl Dix. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And before we go out, there's something I wanted to read to you, and it's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's something all of us ought to be thinking about all the time, all right? Three things have to happen in order for there to be real and lasting change for the better. One, people have to fully confront the actual history of this country and its role in the world up to today and the terrible consequences of this. Two, people have to dig seriously and scientifically into how this system of capitalism and imperialism actually works and what this actually causes in the world. Three, people have to look deeply into the solution to all of this. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And think about that. Write to me about it. Let me know what you're thinking, all right? We're going to go out now with a piece from Savage Rose, and it's a piece that I've always really liked. It's called Revolution. Talk to you again next week.
Goodbye, some revolution.